The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
A mixed week for stocks. Ignorance is no longer bliss. GDP hits 4%, but questions remain. And our guest today, Dr. Kevin Dachson, from the Innovative Genetics Institute. All this and much more on episode number 573 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And a good Sunday to you. Coming up into the end of July, this is Andrew Horowitz. I'm your host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Good news, markets are on pace for another good month. That's some good things that are going on there. We have a good guest today, a great guest today. I'm really excited about this because, you know, I've been talking about this CRISPR technology, this amazing field of biotechnology that has really brought up a lot of questions and some answers, but we're going to get a few more, hopefully, out of Dr. Dachson. Before we get started, before we go on further, I want to mention a few things, some housekeeping, some updates, some things you need to know. And then we'll get into some areas of economics and earnings and then right to our guest today. Next week, we have a great guest coming on. We have Chris DeRose, who is a Bitcoin evangelist. We'll get to the bottom what exactly that means. I met him at a startup conference this week or last week. I was at this really good conference. The conference itself wasn't that great. I thought there could be a lot more that could have been done to make the conference a little bit more interesting. But there was a few panels that I attended. And one of them was on startups. One of them was on women and investing. One of them was on the whole area of understanding more about cryptocurrencies, coins, a few more things. Anyway, he was on one of the panels, and I really thought he was an interesting fellow. So I'm going to bring him on next week for the show. So we'll have a lot to talk about there. I also want to mention that I received a good amount of emails recently about where to find my book, The Disciplined Investor. So maybe I haven't mentioned that recently. Go over to Amazon. The audiobook is available. You can download it right on Amazon. The audiobook, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success. So you can go grab a copy for yourself. And as you are podcast listeners, probably the audiobook is one of the better ways to actually get the information. And a lot of the information there is quite timeless, I think. You know, investing basics, understanding fundamentals and technical analysis and options, even guaranteed investment contracts, a whole host of things in that book that I think you'll find very interesting. Listener questions. We're going to be hitting those next week. If you haven't done so, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and hit the Ask Andrew button. And when you do so, you'll just be able to submit a question. So do that. We'll get to that next week. And finally, you can follow me over on Twitter at the handle Andrew Horowitz, one word. So make sure to do that to get the latest information, be the first to find out when podcasts are released. And that's Andrew Horowitz, one word, just simply Andrew Horowitz on Twitter. All right, what do we got? Let's take a few moments before we get to our guest, talk about eco and earnings, just to understand a bit more about kind of what's going on, because it was an interesting week. We had a mixed week for markets, of course. The S&P 500 was up. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up. Small caps got hammered. The NASDAQ got hit. But generally speaking, there was some real good in the week, and there was some real bad in the week. I guess GDP is probably the first thing we want to talk about, right? GDP came in at 4.1%. Expectations were all over the place. I mean, we saw that it was 3.7 to 5%. I think there was even somebody over 5% in the estimates. Now, consensus was right about 4%, right in line with where we came in. And if you remember, I've been absolutely pounding the desk. I mean, pounding the desk about this whole idea of this pull forward effect. The whole thought that, you know, it looks like there could be a move to really build inventories, There's a potential for a lot of the concern over the higher cost associated with tariffs to really build on our GDP and on manufacturing, as I've mentioned, inventory growth. And that's exactly what happened. Export growth was off the charts. One of the inputs into GDP is exports. And you saw that the component was, something like 100+% over normal. I think it was even higher than that, actually. I think it was like more than close to 200%. But the actual fact remains that this is exactly what I have been theorizing about. Whereas we are going to see that there is a substantial amount of pull forward into the fear that costs will be going up. Therefore, manufacturers and retailers are going to want to get their goods now before the price goes up. Exactly what we saw in 2014, 2015 with the increase in retail sales from Japan. I talked about this at length on DH Unplugged. I talked about this last week as well. So I'm not going to get into the real nitty gritty of all of this in the charts, et cetera. You can find out more about that if you listen to those. But just let's focus on the fact that there is this situation going on. The reality has hit. And no wonder why, after the print, after the details came out, markets rolled over. Because if we had such a good number and the economy was running at a 4.1%, and basically it wasn't due to one thing that could be a blip, markets should have held pretty well, but they rolled pretty hard. And I think it was because of the realization that this is exactly what's happening, that there is an artificiality involved inside of these numbers right now that is causing to have this blip that is not sustainable. So this manufacturing push to get products, the exports that went up substantially ahead of this, is all pushing to this 4.1% annualized level. That is even in the face of a strong dollar. So when we have all this happening, you have to realize that probably next quarter, man, there may be some carry forward into next quarter's GDP, but probably the quarter after that, we're going to see a significant drop off. And that's why that there has been concern about a recession rising. Now, I'm not calling for a recession two quarters out because I don't think that's going to happen. Three quarters out, four quarters out, will we see negative GDP growth a couple quarters in a row? Possibly, if in fact this continues. But this gigantic export number and the component inside of GDP that really pushed it higher is a very big concern and needs to be on your watch list. It can't be ignored. And this is something that we've seen, haven't we? The fact that information that seems to be known is ignored. So we're going to give a plus one for information that everybody should have known, but they ignored right there. Just hold that to the side. We got a plus one for information that was known, but was ignored. And in fact, one of the things that's interesting is that this is being touted as one of the best GDPs ever in decades. Just to make sure we are all very clear, that is not the case. Anybody that's keeping score, you'll realize that there were several GDP prints over 4% during the past few years. Let's just take a look. We had a 5.1% in the second quarter of 2014. We had a 4.9% in the third quarter of 2014. We had a 4.7% in the fourth quarter of 2011. We had a 4.5% in the fourth quarter of 2009. So this is by far not the best we've seen. It's a good one, but it's not the best we've seen. And it's being spread all over the internet and social media that this is just an amazing number that nobody has reached in decades. Just to clarify once again, not true. So just a little note on that. Now, let's switch over to Facebook. We're going with the theme of ignorance is not bliss, no longer bliss. The stock dropped about 20%. It was the biggest one-day market cap drop ever, the biggest. $130, $40 billion of market cap lost on Facebook after their earnings. And why? What happened? Well, there was disappointment on the news that they reported that revenues will be dropping over the foreseeable future. Just like they said in the last several quarterly conference calls. And they blame it on some of their safeguarding of user information, changing of what they're doing, the ad streams inside of stories, etc. There's a variety of things that they looked at. But basically, this is not a new item that they're reporting here. So what does that mean? Well, let's put another plus one for information that everyone should have known but ignored. There's no question that this information was something they telegraphed, but totally, not only ignored, by the way, but when we look at the information here about what was going on with Facebook and the fact about what actually happened with Cambridge Analytica and what the net effects of that was, totally ignored. Not only was it ignored, it was bought up. The stock hit all-time highs just days before and into this and was on a parabolic move, even with all the knowledge of what was happening with the company, as the company stated very clearly in the last couple of conference calls. So there's another plus one. What do we got? Plus two now. Now Twitter. Twitter dropped 20%. As the company had less than exciting, definitely less than exciting earnings report outlook, a lot less active users, major drop in their active users in some areas around the world. Plus, they mentioned a significant decrease in accounts due to fake news and bots, continuation of them dropping accounts and pulling accounts because of the potential for fake and bots and other things. Now, this is not new. This was reported a few weeks back. They talked about how there was it was 70 or 80 million accounts that were removed. Even though the company said, well, that doesn't really count in our monthly active user number, and we really have never counted them before. So I'm not exactly sure why, in fact, they need to telegraph that a few weeks before the earnings announcement. But once again, another plus one for information that was known but was ignored. So right now we have three separate, very clear and distinct instances of when we've had information at our fingertips that was not only, it wasn't speculative, it was information provided by the company, it was information provided by the numbers. GDP being a little more speculative there, but clearly we knew that there was something going on, that we'd probably see an increase due to the tariffs, etc. And what is that telling us? What is that saying? I mean, are we going to continue to ignore information? I guess because we're being trained to see what we want to see. I mean, that's what's really, it seems to me that what's happening, right? We're being trained. We're being hypnotized into believing that the news that's out there isn't true because maybe the stock is moving higher. Or maybe because everybody is saying something, oh, it's going to be great. It's going to be one of the best quarters. And because we also, I think, have in the back of our heads that information that we don't believe is, it's probably fake news. This whole fake news push is a major problem to us as investors. It's brainwashing us and training us. Essentially, making us believe, I guess, that we want to just focus on what we want to see is true and the rest of it, totally disregard anything we don't believe in or believe and agree with. This is probably one of the biggest problems for investors. It brings up this confirmation bias to a whole new level. I mean, just to the stratosphere. And it's brought up to levels that I think now become major hindrances when we're investing, because we start looking at the news, we start looking at social media, we start looking at the headlines, and even for the most seasoned investor, it becomes a point that you scratch your head and you're thinking, oh, maybe my thesis is wrong here. Maybe the information that I have, the inputs that I'm using, maybe there's just something missing from this, and stock is still going up, and I'm not gonna play then. I mean, on the other hand, this is possibly something that could be seized on as an opportunity for anybody that's short biased or maybe even a bear in their trading process, realizing that there is this optimism out there and disregard for anything that's bad. And not only disregard for anything is bad, but an absolute disdain to a point that it's negated, entirely negated from any of the analysis. That's exactly what happened with Facebook and Twitter. There's no question about that in my mind. So maybe we wanted to look at the hype and realize that there is this desire, you know, this overwhelming desire to ignore and disregard any negative news or insight, and there maybe in lies some benefit on the short side of the equation. I mean, I still think that earnings are looking pretty good, generally speaking, from a lot of companies. And a lot of it, of course, we know is due to the fact that there has been a substantial amount of revenue growth we've seen. But also, more importantly, earnings growth is really good. And a lot of that is the bottom line margin expansion due to the fact that we have a very favorable tax condition that has been brought into the entire process right now. But realize that maybe there is a time that now all of a sudden, once we see this Twitter, this Facebook, and possibly what's going to be the end product of our GDP push that goes on, and there's going to be a light bulb that goes off and people are going to say, whoa, wait a second. And a company like Tesla that's continually losing money, maybe it's not as good as we think it is. Maybe the information that's coming out is on the positive side. Maybe that's fake news. Maybe I shouldn't let my confirmation bias training that has been ingrained and pushed into me to a point of almost a brainwash. Maybe I should start thinking about really what's going on and what's being said, being telegraphed, and what is in black and white. Not all the hype. Something to consider. Just something to consider. But I think it was a real fascinating week overall. All right, with that, I think I got through all the housekeeping. I told you about Twitter. I told you about, yep, that's all good. All right, we're good. I think we're good. All right, how about we just get right to our guests? Because I really do want to get deep into this whole CRISPR discussion and find out a little bit more about a lot of the technology. And a lot of people have been writing me, asking me about, hey, can you give me some basics of what is this CRISPR? So we're going to get to that right now with our guest. And our very special guest today is Dr. Kevin Doxand, and he's a science communication specialist at the Innovative Genomics Institute. And this is an academic research partnership between UC Berkeley and UC San Francisco, that their purpose is to develop and deploy DNA engineering technologies to solve real-world problems. And we're going to be really focusing in on here is on CRISPR. And just to mention the high level of depth we have here, Kevin, Dr. Dawson, he graduated in biophysics from John Hopkins. So that's pretty cool. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, anytime.
So let's talk about CRISPR. And this has been a topic of discussion. There's been some real excitement around it, controversy around it. And at the same time, I think a lot of people hear the acronym and don't really understand. So I thought we'd start off basically, what is CRISPR?
Yeah, so CRISPR, which stands for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeat, is actually a bacterial immune system. So although it's hit the news since 2012, it's been around in bacteria and archaea for billions of years. Okay. And so it's just a way of these organisms to defend themselves against viral attack. But I guess that's not why we're here today to talk. We're here to mainly discuss how scientists have developed these viral immunity proteins into world-shattering genome-editing technology.
Yeah, but can we back up for a second? You know, I'm always kind of fascinated about how was this discovered, and what somebody said all of a sudden, hey, that I have an idea for this, you know, because it's pretty complex. We're dealing with really the root of our DNA, right, in this whole process. And how does somebody discover that? How does somebody say, oh, I think this could be an interesting thing to do?
So the CRISPR field, there's a lot of great scientists across the world still actively studying how this works as a bacterial immune system. And in particular, Jennifer Doudna, who I did my PhD with at UC Berkeley, her and Emmanuel Charpentier were interested in studying this one particular CRISPR protein called Cas9. And they were interested in looking at how does Cas9 find a DNA target, and specifically a viral target that's attacking a bacteria. And they were able to uncover the intricacies of this and realize that, wow, you can actually program this protein pretty easily to cut any sequence of DNA that you want.
So, you know, that's actually, I think in the terminology, it's called scissoring, right?
Yeah, you can. Well, I like to think of these as molecular scissors.
So what they do is they go in and they look for a specific, you're programming this to go after a specific sequence or something on the DNA sequence, the genome, and find the quote unquote bad stuff, right? Obviously, and then get rid of it.
Yeah. So what's cool about CRISPR is that the way we program these proteins is by changing out this RNA. So RNA is similar to DNA, kind of think of it as DNA's cousin. And RNA, it's really simple to make in the lab. And what you can do is this Cas9 protein binds to this small piece of RNA, 20 letters long, stick out. And those 20 letters are what search around to find the complementary DNA letters. So when I say complementary, A binds with T, G binds with C inside a DNA double helix. And so it's really simple. You change those letters, and then you get to change what DNA you want to target.
And the RNA, if I remember back from my biology classes, the RNA was the messenger, right? It kind of gave the instructions. Is that a correct statement?
Yeah, so a lot of RNA is called messenger RNA, and that's what goes on to make protein. But actually, a lot of RNA doesn't make protein at all, and we call that non-coding RNA. So in the context of this CRISPR scenario, I'm referring to this non-coding RNA.
So once you take this and you change it and essentially, you know, you're doing like I think we can look at it like this to make it very simplistic. It's, you're in a Word document, the Microsoft Word document, and you're doing a find and replace process with this to take out the word hello and change it to the word hi. And it's kind of like what you're doing on a biological basis. Is that as easy as it gets?
Exactly. You can think of Cas9 as kind of clicking Control F.
Right.
Then maybe you want to add a space or delete some letters. Now, Cas9, like we were talking about before, is really just a molecular scissor. And what scientists are working on now is what do you do after you make that cut? So these proteins aren't involved in the paste part of the cut and paste process. So once it's up to you to decide how do you want to paste and fix what's going on.
Right.
That's a little harder. But
yeah. That's harder. So where are we? So, well, let me kind of back up. What kind of diseases are primarily, in theory, being looked at with this technology?
Well, that's a great question. There's a whole range of diseases. So a lot of them, or most of them, being genetic diseases, because this is a tool that targets our genes. So some early clinical trials you'll see coming up will be sickle cell anemia. People are really working actively on Huntington's disease. There's some genetic blindness diseases and various nerve diseases, muscular dystrophy, cystic fibrosis. And then there's also a lot of great progress being done on just using this to treat cancer. So, yeah.
Now, you know, it's interesting because obviously testing, I don't think there's any human testing that has been allowed in the U.S., if I'm not mistaken, but I think China just allow for something?
Yeah, so China used non-viable human embryos. So these were embryos that weren't going to turn into a human, and they did some testing in those. Now, in the U.S., you're not allowed to do that using federal funding. There was some work done up in Oregon doing that. But so what I was talking about before, treating sickle cell disease, you don't have to do that in a human embryo. You can do that to a 30, 40-year-old person. And so those clinical trials and that testing in humans will be done pretty soon.
You know, it's interesting because there's, at the same time, you know, we're in the, I think the early stages, if I could probably see this, the, you know, in terms of what I've seen at least, is, you know, we're obviously pre-testing in a lot of areas. And there's a lot of, just a lot of controversy over this because on one hand, you have, first of all, the efficacy of the particular process to begin with. Okay. And there's a back and forth of whether it's working or not working. And you got a variety of companies that are working on it, plus obviously the private sector working on it, et cetera. Then you have the other side of it, which doesn't even deal with that, is the, oh my God, we're going to create a superhuman or, you know, change the race, or, oh my, we're going to get, you know, somebody's going to have the ability to create, you know, an 8,000 pound cow in order to, you know, change it up so that we have a lot more meat available and all that. But really it gets back to the, some of the real craziness, which there is something to be said about this, is the concern about changing the core sequence in a way that messes with humanity. Is that something that you hear a lot?
Yeah, so I guess that particular concern, I think, applies a lot to editing our germ cells, so our sperm or egg or embryos, and that gets passed down through the generations. And so that's really kind of changing our genetic trajectory. I don't know if those questions really arise so much when you're editing your somatic cells, which are your eyes and your liver and anything that's not a germ cell.
Right. And just to get back on this, because I did some reading, there was a piece on this recently, and there's a differential about what cells are edited in terms of post-edit, we'll call it, those cells that are actually passed down genetically to the next generation, and how there are some that do in fact get passed down and some that don't. And the ones that are targeted that do not get passed down are really a fix of a particular, we'll say, one person or one disease that is not a genetically, that not genetically then passed down to the next generation, right? That's a demarcation point.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's another article last week that was put out, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago, that really put a real a damper on some of this. There's this constant talk, and it was one about 6 months ago, about the results have created more problems when we see some testing in mice, et cetera, than just the fix. So I guess there was some cancer that was created from it, and there could be aberrations that are created from this as well. Can you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think especially for the audience listening to this podcast, as well as we've talked with a lot of investors and people interested in looking at, you know, where's this technology and going in a couple of years, and how are these companies dealing with these studies coming out? And so there have been, you know, every 4 months or so a study that says CRISPR causes cancer, or CRISPR, when it makes a cut, and this was the one last week, when it makes a cut in DNA, you can get large rearrangements and unpredictable changes in your DNA. And so at least at the Innovative Genomics Institute, we're trying to come out with a opinion piece after each of these studies, kind of explaining really what was going on in that paper. And so for the cancer one, the titles were a bit misleading coming out of the popular press, because those were very, very specific cell lines in a petri dish and not in, you know, a human, and really weren't as clinically relevant as some other studies. And a lot of what people are seeing was predicted to happen. And so there was one paper that said CRISPR causes a huge immune response in humans. And that is the case. If you use certain proteins, you can see an autoimmune response when you're doing something. And so, but scientists had predicted that this would happen, and have already taken measures to fix that. And so it's interesting seeing all these papers come out and how the field's reacting and how it's even adjusting the stock market and these company values.
Yeah, because the one last week that I saw that had something to do with immune and or cancer, they were talking about using a double strand versus single strand technique. And the two companies that came out right afterwards and said, listen, we have found that that is the case. Again, I'm talking to a scientist about this and I'm a layperson, but my understanding was it was something about the double strand technique of using this and how it did in fact cause some problems. Whereas the company said, hey, you know what? We have seen that as well. That is not the technology that we're using though. With, in particular, Editas and CRISPR Therapeutics.
Yeah. And so actually our institute, the IGI, came out with a paper today, like an hour ago, that compared the double-stranded versus the single-stranded. And just to kind of give a glimpse of how much we're learning, it's even this repair process. So after you make the cut, do you use a double-strand piece of DNA or a single-stranded piece of DNA? Understanding how that DNA gets inserted into that cut was still kind of this black box. And so these companies and a lot of us are doing gene editing with these different DNA, but we're still uncovering the basic science of how it's all happening. And so as we understand more and more, we'll be able to circumvent issues that arise and hopefully open doors to new possibilities.
So I guess the question then I have to ask you is, you know, obviously I know where you're coming from and let's put that into perspective here, but what is your true bottom line opinion on this? Are we in the early stages of something that is maybe, who knows, we'll see what happens with this? Are we in maybe, you know, second stage? I'm not talking about clinically now. I'm just talking about concept. Are we in second stage where it's like, yeah, this is happening, this will happen, and there's a lot of good that will come from this. We just have to go through the process. Where are we in all this?
So I think compared to other technologies, CRISPR right now, nearly anything that, if CRISPR is a hammer, anything that has DNA is now a nail. And so people are using CRISPR in, we're keeping track of all the organisms, and it's above 150 now organisms that have been edited using CRISPR, crops. People are using CRISPR for diagnostics and for treating, hopefully addressing this antibiotic resistance pandemic that's coming up, possibly eradicating malaria using gene drives. So, I mean, that's getting outside of CRISPR just using to treat a genetic disease in a person, but CRISPR as a gene editing technology, because it's so diversified, it's already shook the foundation of basic science, and there's no turning back from that. Its role in treating genetic diseases, that people have a lot of hope, but that's also contingent upon these technologies are going to be 100,000, 800,000, $1 million procedures. And so getting it to the general public also depends on health insurance and all of that, just keeping up with the technology.
I would venture to say, though, this is just my take on this. If it actually proves out that you could eradicate sickle cell in an adult, or for that matter, you know, if there is signs of it, I don't know when sickle cell actually comes into play, if it's in embryonic stage or if it's later, but if at any point in the entire lifespan of a person that sickle cell can be eradicated, or genetic blindness, which would be amazing, or Huntington's disease, or what, muscular dystrophy, I mean, if any of this could be either eradicated or, for that matter, even lessened, right, you know, to a point, and it would seem to me that whether it needs continuing treatment or, you know, one shot and you're done kind of thing, because it, here you go, just edited, you're back to normal. That's kind of a cool thing. And I would think that there'd be a lot of desire for companies. Obviously, the pharmaceutical companies would hate it because then they can't, you know, keep on them their drugs to get this going. But the insurance companies would love it because they're like, well, all right, so we'll pay $1 million, but we don't have to go $5 million in the hole over time with, you know, an elongated life with a disease like this. It would seem to me that there'll be a battle, but insurance companies would be very willing to do so.
Yeah, that's an excellent point when you weigh the one time versus the constant fix over a person's life. One thing also to keep in mind is that you have companies that spend, it takes, what, about $1 billion to take a drug to market, and you're only going to invest that much money on a drug if a lot of people have that condition. But I think a lot of people are hopeful with CRISPR because the real target of this will also be rare diseases. So if you have someone in the world that has a mutation at a very unique spot in the genome, no big company is going to make a drug to treat that one person. But if we have a technology where we can swap out just a few letters in this molecular scissor and target that one part in that person's genome, and we can do it, the possibilities are endless. Now we can begin to treat all these rare diseases that no company will ever go after.
Yeah. But what about these so-called, I guess called biohackers? You know, I've seen, by the way, there's been some very reckless, I don't know, what propaganda or advertisements, or I don't know what they are. There's a guy on YouTube that says, yeah, I'm going to inject myself with this CRISPR stuff and show you how it's going to help me. I don't know what particular thing he was injecting, and I'm not sure what the deal was. But he was injecting something to hopefully, I guess, for stamina, for some kind of a benefit. I'm thinking, I don't really understand what that has to do with this. But, and I don't know if he's just injecting water. I don't know what he's doing. But this whole idea of biohacking, is that something that the community is concerned about?
Yeah, so you have this one person who lives in Oakland who you're referring to, and I think he did inject me some Cas9 that may, I think, was targeting a muscle gene.
Right.
And if anything, he's just going to get an infection from the needle. That's not how any of this works. But we have been to, my colleagues and I have been to community labs in kind of garage spaces, where people are trying to just learn how this works. And it's not as easy as people make it sound. Like, these people in these labs are trying to make a simple bacteria in a dish glow green. And so we're working with people to try to help create tools and educational material so that they can do this safely and learn a lot in the process and get excited about science. But yeah, unfortunately, you have those people who steal the headline who don't really know what they're doing.
But it seems to me, first of all, dangerous having some kind of a garage-based. This is not just this is not a band or a workshop where you're going to be, you know, putting together a table. I mean, and then, you know, there's a lot of things that I just don't understand why, what's the mindset of the people that are doing this? I don't get it.
Oh, so for like the example of the ones we saw.
Yeah. These guys that are doing this stuff.
Yeah. Well, the ones that are doing it well, like we visited one in Boston, for example, and they hold seminars, and anyone in the community can come, and they teach them about what we're doing right now, talking about the latest advancements. They have a few incubators and centrifuges, and you can do some experiments. It's just like an intro high school lab in a way. And they have to get insurance from the city, and things have to be safety regulated. And yeah, they're also doing some cool science. So some of them are studying microbiomes. So the bacteria that exist in different organisms. And so they are trying to do some really cool science, but they are doing it safely and trying to educate people at the same time. But every now and then you'll get these one-off.
This doesn't happen with other. Have you seen this kind of phenomena with other types of drugs or whatever you want to call this? And is it just because the potential is so absolutely incredible that if we can, in fact, change the genetics of individuals for whatever the reason is, and let's just for a moment say for the good, just for the moment, say for the good. Is this something that has just captured the fascination and the intrigue of so many people that they're just setting it up in their house? I mean, this is not like setting up a woodworking class in your house or, you know, setting up a how to sell on eBay thing or multi-level marketing that you have, you know, community functions and things like that. I mean, is it because it's open source? It's so available. I don't get it doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, so I think the guy who injected himself is an awful example, because these other people aren't going to inject themselves with anything. They're trying to use some simple biotechnology to make a bacteria glow, or to make a tomato, make more tomato branches on its. So I think these people aren't creating drugs. They're just studying the world around them, doing kind of cool experiments. They're not trying to edit themselves.
Right. So they're trying to make their farm a little bit more, have greater output, or they're seeing what can be done with this in a personal humanistic standpoint. So because it is, with regard to biology, and it is the building block, as we call it, right? Biology 101 of everything. The applications for this outside of just the curing of a specific disease or maybe helping. Talk about the whole area of, as you mentioned, plant life, animals, things of that nature. Where are the possibilities?
Yeah, so when people ask me, where's my first interaction with CRISPR going to be? Like, when will it impact my life personally?
Right. Yeah.
My immediate response is food. And so people have already used CRISPR to edit various crops, usually to make them drought resistant or disease resistant, or provide better nutrition to them. So actually the FDA and the USDA and the EPA are all trying to figure out what is this new technology and how do we regulate it? How is it different from the old technology versus how is it similar to just what biology does in general and plants evolved in natural breeding? Your first interaction with CRISPR will probably be through the supermarket.
I mean, I would think that there is the likelihood if a company can show that. See, there's two sides to this, right? So on one hand, if we can cure all these diseases, these pharmaceutical companies will be really aggravated. Unfortunately, I know this sounds terrible, but they'll be really aggravated, and they would want to say, maybe let's buy this company and shut down the whole process. Forget about morality, you know? On the other hand, you see like a Monsanto who makes, and a variety of other companies that make all these different fertilizers, et cetera, that are trying to do the same thing. Maybe like, oh, that's interesting. We could buy them and use them for our, we'll call it farming and agricultural business side of things. That would be something they could possibly buy one of these companies for as well. Again, I'm not saying they're for sale. I'm not even suggesting really this will happen. But then you have the other side of the playing field, you know, of the ones that don't want this to happen, want to shut this down. So I get there's probably a lot of push and pull going on in the general community about CRISPR that's probably prompting some of these negative articles and also the positive spin on it as well. Would you say that's true?
I would definitely say that's true. I think the economics of this is complicated. It is very complicated. I think one thing to bring up is that because CRISPR is a bit easier and cheaper to use than previous technologies, people would love to see things coming out of academic labs make it to market. So there are stockpiles of edited crops in labs across America, academic university labs, that could really benefit the general public. But there's no way a lab can afford the millions of dollars it takes to bring something to market with the current regulations. And so people are hoping that these smaller groups, these labs, can actually, without this economic, pursuit of these larger companies, like they themselves can start entering the market.
So who's funding you? Who's funding the particular lab at UC Berkeley?
So the Innovative Genomics Institute is all philanthropically funded.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So there's no outside businesses that are pushing anything into any. I mean, I'm sure there are some in some labs around there, obviously, because only a handful of companies right now that are actually publicly traded that are involved in this. There's probably a lot of smaller ones that are privately held, but there's only a few of them that are publicly traded.
Yeah, I think one example, so we do have a partnership with Mars, and we're trying to edit cacao to become disease resistant. And so obviously they have a stake in making sure that cacao doesn't, you know, get depleted in Africa and the crops die. So we are working with them to create disease-resistant cacao, but there's also in the paperwork, there's wording to really help ensure that the farmers in Africa benefit. So a lot of the work we do at our institute isn't even so much first world focuses. A lot of our work is really trying to help the broader global community.
What's a cacao?
So a cacao is, that's where chocolate comes from.
Oh.
So yeah.
Cocoa.
Yeah.
Cocoa?
Yeah. Cocoa. Yeah.
Oh. All right. Yeah. You say ketchup, I say catsup. Yeah, whatever. All right, what else are we going to add to this? Okay, so we have this genetic diversity we're looking at, the concern about some, obviously, the religious groups that are very concerned about this, that get involved in some of this, and probably will be a lot of concern there. So what's the next thing that we're going to see? What's the next thing that we really should be excited about? What's the next thing that is coming down the pike?
One thing that I'm pretty excited about, and I don't know if I'm biased because this company spun off from the Doudna Lab. I have some friends in it, but people are using, so we were talking earlier about Cas9 as kind of the go-to protein for genome editing, but there are a slew of Cas proteins. So Cas13 and Cas12 in particular, people are developing those to become really cool diagnostic tools. And so I won't go into the whole details of it all. We're actually creating a little whiteboard video on our website to help explain it, but people are using these proteins to detect very, very, very small levels of DNA. And this DNA could be either cancerous DNA, it could be Zika, it could be in an oil spill, it could be just to show, does this person have blue eyes or black eyes?
So this is kind of
fascinating technology.
Diagnostics, which would go in and find these markers of sorts.
So what you do, you have to take the sample out. So for the instance of Zika, you could take a blood sample.
Right.
And then you use this protein and you say, oh, there are very small amounts of Zika. And the output, in their case, would be the tube would glow.
Right. So that would be the marker on that. Yeah. I keep thinking Fantastic.
That's really exciting.
I keep on thinking the movie Fantastic Voyage. You know, little thing going in there. Finding it and snipping. You've seen that movie, right?
Yeah.
I keep on envisioning that when we get to that level with that. So, I appreciate you coming. Hopefully, we can keep on providing our audience with really good in-depth information on this. It's a very complicated area, obviously. It's a very sophisticated, unknown, a lot of controversy, but just fascinating. So, Dr. Doxson, I appreciate you spending some time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we'll talk soon. Well, that's going to wrap up the show today. Kind of some really fascinating discussion about this technology. And there's, again, a lot of really interesting things that can be done here. There's some, of course, some edgy morality that could be maybe looked at in terms of, you know, the bad actors that will get involved in this in some way or another. But generally speaking, I think there is a great opportunity here. Now, we'll have to see how this whole thing plays out. If, in fact, it can work in ways that are promised. Take a look at the stocks. CRISPR, CRSP, and Editas is two names that are of interest. Very volatile, by the way. And full disclosure, I own both of those. But these are areas that I think... Could any good news that comes out of this, you can see a massive move. Now, again, this is cutting edge or even further back from that technology in the biotechnology area. And again, stocks that are involved here usually have a substantial amount of move. I mean, we've seen anywhere from CRISPR about a year and a change ago at 16. Now it's at, $50 per share. It was recently at 65. Goldman Sachs is an $80 target on it, but we'll see what happens there. Anyway, I want to thank you for joining me. We'll see you again next week for some Bitcoin evangelism. Looking forward to that and versus Bitcoin vandalism, or maybe we'll talk about that as well. Have a great week, great weekend. I'll see you again there. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.